President Trump says that if the Iranian side doesn't behave, things are going to get bad. He's going to go down a more fiery rhetoric, another path, basically to punish these children that are not doing what they're told in Iran. And I'm sure that's going to have an effect, and they're going to do exactly what he told them to do. We'll see about that. Meanwhile, there's some fiery rhetoric going on in the Senate, but some arguments between some senators and the Secretary of War, and how much of that is true, how much of that is just fiction, we'll see where it's going to go. But the bottom line, this is not going well. The war is not going well for the United States, whatever President Trump says, whatever Secretary of War Pete Hegseth says. And to try and put some real sanity in this, we have back with us Larry Johnson, former CIA analyst and dresser extraordinaire for this shirt. and it's desired everywhere these days. And Larry is literally all over the place. Everybody wants to hear what Larry has to say. So we're always grateful to have you on the show. Welcome back, Larry.
Hey, thanks so much, Danny.
Well, listen, let's jump first of all with what President Trump said. This is just a few hours ago here. He said, from this point forward, anytime the Islamic Republic of Iran shoots at a ship in the Strait of Hormuz, which I think has already happened this morning, by the way, whether it be by missile, rocket, drone, or any other device, the United States will bomb or destroy one bridge or power plant, apparently up to Trump's desire, including those next to or in the capital city of Tehran. First of all, do you think Trump will actually follow through with that? And is this going to be a deterrent to Iran not to do any of those things?
Yes, he'll follow through. No, it will not be a deterrent. In fact, it's going to create more heartache, headache, and problems for the other Gulf countries. Because Iran said, look, you do that to us, we're going to take any country that's allied with you, we're going to take out their bridges or power plants, or as they've been doing in Kuwait, the desalinization plants. So Iran's ready to go tit for tat on this, and they've already proven it. Moreover, we got word overnight that the United States has pulled out of at least two of its military bases throughout the region, including its presence at Mawafiq al-Salti in Jordan. That was the air base that took the hit the other day that killed at least three. And, they said it killed two and one was missing, but they finally pieced together some of the body parts. And I'm not exaggerating to say, well, yeah, that looks like this is this young corporal. I mean, it's god awful. These people are being killed for nothing, for no good reason.
And, you know, that really raises an issue here about that capability. First of all, let's take a look here. The United States, this is what we have been attacked overnight. Apparently, we really did ramp up the attacks last night, and these 11 different cities were hit at various times. But you know what? It seems interestingly to me is not on this list is any of these mountain ranges where all these missile factories are, the drone factories, the drone launching points, et cetera. What good does it do, Larry, to hit whatever is here? And CENTCOM keeps putting out all these cool images of jets taking off of aircraft carriers and stuff blowing up on the ground, which, according to Professor Morandi, we had earlier on today, some of those are probably decoys anyway. We don't even know for sure what all those things are on there. But there's a long list. But we're not hitting the one thing that actually does matter. Why do you suppose that is?
Well, one, we can't hit it. It's underground. So, they're launching from underground sites. These sites are built to withstand nuclear blasts. That's the first problem. Second, though, I think goes to the assumption, the false assumption, but nonetheless, it's the operating assumption for the West or for the United States military and the Trump administration. They believe that if they just create enough pain, enough economic pain, enough civil suffering, that the people of Iran will rise up and overthrow the Islamic regime. They still really believe that, even after having seen 45 million Iranians in the streets commemorating the memory of the Ali Khamenei. I think if you've read one of Robert Barnes' recent pieces, where he went through, there was polling done, and he shows what the actual mindset of the Iranians is. And it's not at all what the United States thinks. You know, the Iranians, they're going to support the Islamic Republic.
And Larry, let me ask, while Gary's playing that video right there, when it turns to the black and white stuff here, there's a number of things. Some of it looks like dilapidated. I mean, I don't even know what some of these things are. Tell me, what is that that's been hit there? Can you identify any of those things?
No, none. I have no idea.
It looks like an empty building there, by the way. It looks like a junk heap.
Well, see, you know, what would be interesting is if the United States would then provide the same video footage for what Iran has been hitting over the last 5 months. When you go down the list of radars and satellite communication systems that they have destroyed, it's a list of over 20. So the United States is now, and this is one of the, is now blind. This is one of the problems that happened the other day at Mowafiq al-Salti. They only got a last-minute warning that there was an inbound missile. Before, you know, a year ago in the 12-day war in June, the United States radars are able to pick up immediately upon launch. And so you'd have a 30 to 40-minute warning sometimes before something actually hit. We don't have that now. We're lucky if we get a minute or two. And it just shows that Iran took did some very precise planning, and I'm sure it was with the assistance of the Russians and or Chinese in identifying targets, coming up with a battle plan, how to use their missiles, what to take out, what to destroy, how to gradually cripple the United States, which they have. And then that has been compounded by the fact that the United States has admitted it's withdrawing military personnel from King Faisal base, air base, which is, I understand that's in Saudi Arabia, but it's right on the near the border with Jordan. They've closed Mowafiq al-Salti. We really don't have any further presence at the 5th Fleet headquarters in Bahrain. The same at a couple of the military bases in Kuwait, the army bases. So you remember way back on April 7th, in their 14-point plan, Iran asked the United States, hey, we want you to remove your forces from the Middle East. Well, now Iran's doing it for us. You know, they're moving us out whether we like it or not.
And let's take a look at some of the reason for that. This is some of the targeting that's happened from the 12th to the 19th. There's another one here from, I guess, the last couple of days prior to that, too. But you see, basically, some of the same targets are being hit because we just don't. You mentioned this before. We don't have that many targets. And when you see that they're hitting all these things here, and I think you've also said, I believe you've put on one of our group chats here on Signal that, look, that we don't need, or the Iranians don't need targeting data from China or Russia, which is some are saying, because everybody knows where these things are.
Right.
And so that makes them easy to hit. And when you start talking about this kind of missile capabilities coming out of Iran, I mean, this tells me, you tell me if I'm wrong, this tells me that they are very much still capable of having as many drones or missiles, it seems like, as they wanted to launch.
Yeah. And it'd be one thing if they were dependent on doing above ground launches. But they're not. They've perfected doing underground launches, launches from caves, launches that, frankly, are difficult to locate. And this creates, the other problem for us, or challenge. You know, in the past, we had a lot of MQ-9 Reapers overflying, trying to overfly Iran. And then that big white elephant known as the MQ-4C Triton, only you can have it for the low, low price of $250 million. And you know what? We'll throw in a couple of coffee mugs as well. I mean, this is like ridiculous. Anyway, they would fly over, they would see a launch, and then so be able to immediately identify the spot, and then we could have a counter battery fire on it. Well, Iran shot down so many MQ-9 Reapers. Remember, and just the airframe on those alone goes for about 30 to 35 million. And then when you attach the optics pod and the weapons pod and the communications pod, it gets up over, the total price is like 65 million.
Wow.
And it looks like Iran has shot down over 30. So we're talking a big chunk of money.
Do you have a sense for what how big our fleet is? How many does that leave?
And that's the other problem. That is, now they haven't like been cranking them out like, you know, Willie's Jeeps during World War II. No, these are in short supply. This is another area where we're seeing depletion of U.S. Military stock and inventories. So, you can't spot those sites. And then Iran is the ones that we have hit were, you know, quickly repaired, back in operation. And so this was a decision that Iran made 23 years ago. After when the first Gulf War, they said, you know what? If we keep anything above ground, then we're going to get wiped out. We got to go underground. And they did. And who did they work with on that? North Korea. Mm. And so North Korea said, oh, let us help you. We got some great ideas. Iran now has an extensive underground city, you know, war machine for both launching, storing, and producing missiles of various types. And now the other part of this is, I keep citing the show you had with Ted Postol, where he went through the accuracy of the PAC-3 missile. It ain't accurate. Less than 10% effective. And yet, so all these bases now are surrounded by air defense systems that don't defend. And then we're evacuating our troops out of there. Well, that's, you know what, boys and girls, that's called retreating. That's what you associate with losing, not winning.
Yeah, and of course that makes sense. That's exactly what we should be doing. But instead, we have our leaders continuing to talk about how, no, actually, we're doing great here. As a matter of fact, some of this, there's been some pretty testy moments going on in the Senate yesterday between both Republican and Democratic senators, ironically, in terms of what are we actually accomplishing here. Now, I'm going to show you a few scenes from that. Some are saying, hey, by the way, Secretary Hegseth, this is what you said in the first few weeks of the war. How'd that work out? We'll get to that in a second. But let's start off, first of all, with the friendly side, and that is Senator Kennedy, who said, hey, about this pickaxe mountain.
Guys, we need straight answers. Do we have the ability to destroy whatever is underneath pickaxe mountain?
Senator, a lot of our capabilities are classified, but if anybody in the world can reach anything on God's green earth, it's the United States military, the most powerful military in the world. It's all about options and trade-offs.
Why does he have to always add that in? The greatest, most powerful military in the world, and then all this other stuff on his head. But first of all, just aside from that nuttiness, is there any truth to what he says? Do we have classified ways to get underneath Pickaxe Mountain?
No, that's simple. No, we don't. We can you know, maybe create a lot of rubble on top of the mountain, but this facility has been specifically designed, and this is based on Alistair Crook's been there, he's seen it. And they've got a variety of insulation, rubber, shock absorbing pads and different things, so they recognize that there's going to be in an explosion, there'll be a blast wave, but this facility's been designed to anticipate that. So, but then that makes the United States is now, once again, the only country to go nuclear, to launch a nuclear weapon. The implications of that would be profound, because I think China and Russia are no longer willing to give us the benefit of the doubt. And they'll see that as an escalation that would force them to have to consider their own nuclear options.
Let's keep the focus on here for a second, because I keep hearing Pickaxe Mountain being mentioned a lot. Obviously, it was here in this Senate hearing. What can you tell us about what is at Pickaxe Mountain, or what do we think is there, and why is it so important to the United States?
I really don't know. I mean, all I know is what I've heard, that they have their enrichment facilities intact underneath, and that they've got there is enriched uranium there. But I suspect Iran also has other sites that we really don't know about. For the administration to come out now and claim, oh, we got to worry about Pickaxe Mountain, they go, whoa, wait a second, you told us last June 25th, as I recall, that you had obliterated their capability. This could be years before they can rebuild. And now you say they've done it in less than a year? Wow. And remember, the head of the Defense Intelligence Agency his organization came out with an analysis that disputed Trump's claims of having obliterated and wiped it out permanently and said, nah, not so fast, guys. We think it's still intact. He got fired, which that brings up a whole nother dimension to this.
Yep.
That what's going on in Washington Post, and I think Wall Street Journal all reported on this lately, that officers within the Pentagon, they've watched, and anybody who steps up to speak truth to power, to bring up uncomfortable facts, the things that don't go along with the administrative narrative, they get fired. So what's happening? Everybody goes silent. Now, you having been in combat, you know what it's like, that if you're the commander and, you know, some private comes up and says, sir, we're going to get ambushed up there. And you say, shut up, private. In fact, I'm putting you on duty. You're going to the stockade. You punish him. Well, at that point, nobody else is going to tell you that there's an ambush. And they'll say, hey, Colonel Davis, go ahead. You lead the way. We'll be right behind you. And you walk in, you get ambushed. They'll let you get ambushed. That's exactly what's going to happen to Trump and Hegseth. They've created an environment where nobody's telling them the truth now, because they recognize the only one who's telling them the truth is J.D. Vance, and he's being, you know, attacked and isolated.
Yeah, and look, let me just show you a graphic example of exactly what you're talking about from today, because that message apparently is getting through to Central Command and their public forward X post that they're publishing here. Is that this is what they put after the 11th night. So this is, I think it was published this morning from yesterday. It says, despite Iranian aggression, the Strait of Hormuz remains open for commercial vessel traffic. But then when you look at CNBC's report, that actually only about 13 crossings a day have been going, which is about 10% of what it was prior to the war. And most of those are going through on the Iranian-approved side. So yeah, it is not open according to what anything we're saying, but that's because that's what President Trump wants to hear. That's exactly what they're being told. But what are your concerns about this public-facing things? Just keep on giving fiction.
Well, at some point, reality sets in. And there was a movie about Salvador Allende, and I don't mean to laugh, but he had come into office in Chile back in the 70s. He had had all the guns confiscated. And then there came this coup, the military coup, but the U.S., the CIA was heavily involved with it, or trying to be. And in this movie, and they weren't trying to be funny, but Salvador Allende turns to his chief of staff and he says, rally the people, tell them to bring their guns. And the guy goes, sir, you took all their guns. And so that moment of reality intruded. Oh, I want to rally the people to protect me. They don't have weapons. And we keep telling ourselves, oh, we're winning. Iran's losing. And then they continue to blast us with missile after missile after missile. We continue to shoot missiles back at them. And then we run out. The PAC-3s, you know, some of the numbers that are out there claiming that they have like 2,000 less left, nonsense. I bet you they're lucky if they've got 400 left worldwide of the PAC-3. Of course, it doesn't matter because it doesn't work, but, you know, let's ignore that fact. Same with the THAAD, same with the Precision Strike Missile, the PRSM. That's the only one the HIMARS fires that can actually reach some distance into Iran. Everything else, you know, they talk about the ATACMs. We're running out of ATACMs. We're running out of Tomahawks. We're running out of JASMs, you know, the Joint Air Strike Missiles that are fired as cruise missiles from the F-35s. I mean, it's not just one category. It's like 9-10 different categories of precision strike missiles that are all in low inventory. And guess what? To build more, we need what are called rare earth minerals. That China is telling us, if you're building military equipment with these, we're not giving it to you. Go look elsewhere, except China controls like 91% of the refining of those minerals. And so, hey, you know what? You can believe in unicorns and the Easter Bunny and Santa Claus. It's great. But The reality is, if you're an adult, you recognize that Santa Claus is coming for your kids. You got to get out your credit card or cash and go to the store. Okay? That's it.
So what is your understanding? Look, let's keep on that for a second. That graphic Gary was showing up there a second ago about how long it takes to actually make more of these mm-hmm. things. And you see those are months on there. So that's a huge number. I mean, 42 apparently can be a little lower for the Patriot, but it's I think the minimum of a herd if they're really pushing it is 2 years for a missile. There's a lot of reasons for that, but we're not going to get it any time that's going to help us in this war here. What do you know about our missile inventory if we literally run out? Because I know you did a month or two ago, maybe a couple of months on this show, you did an analysis based on looking at all the PAC-3s that have been made since they first started, putting the public information out there about how much we were producing, et cetera, is that we could literally run out of them. And I don't know about the JASMs and the Tomahawks, but presumably if we continue going on another 40 days, and we're at day 11 so far in the restart here, what happens if we run out of those? What do we go to next?
Well, okay, yeah, we don't have anything to go to. That's it. We don't have an alternative. And that's the level of planning that's gone into this. Consider the Tomahawk. So right now, the claim is, by a variety of sources, like Wall Street Journal, Center for Strategic International Studies, several, they put the total number right now, 2,000. Well, you know, think back on your military days. CENTCOM's not the only, you know, diner in the dining room. You've got PACOM and you've got UCOM. And I did recently learn, I had missed it. You remember when they changed it to Indo-PACOM? They've now gone back. They said, screw that. We're calling it a PACOM again. So, but Pacific Command. So Pacific Command gets an allocation because their mission statement is we got to be prepared to fight the Chinese. UCOM's got to have a number of those Tomahawks because their mission is to fight Russia. But we only got 2,000 left. And in the first 4 weeks of this of epic fury, CENTCOM used 850 in 4 weeks. So you take that 2,000, divide it among three, gives you about 800 apiece. So right now, CENTCOM would have the equivalent of what it used in 4 weeks. And then after that, what? You know,
I'm sure we've got something else. I mean, we've got, I don't know, dumb bombs. I mean, surely that can't be the only missiles that we have, right?
Yeah, no, they're the only precision missiles we have. That's the point.
Wow. I mean, give me something, man. There's got to be something else. We can't be so foolish that we would literally empty our inventory and then leave us literally powerless against anybody else we would fight. Is that true?
Yes. That's, you know, people can call me a Cassandra, and I'm not trying to build up a reason to, hey, we need to spend more money on the Department of Defense. But the reality is the entire procurement process for weapons was completely divorced from strategic reality, and it did not take into account or think through the implications of an attrition war. That modern warfare, particularly when you start relying upon robots and remotely piloted vehicles, aka drones, can become very, very resource intensive. And instead of doing, you know, like what we've seen in Russia and even in Ukraine, where they'll build $20,000, $30,000 drones, hell, sometimes $10,000 drones that can carry an explosive, we're building a $250 million monster. We built four of them. One of them's already been shot down. And the one we had forward deployed to Jordan, we said, get it the hell out of there. Get it back to Sigonella. Yeah, that's great. Have a weapon system that you can't use because you're afraid it'll get blown up. That's like, you know, we're going to have this aircraft carrier, but we can't let it leave the boatyard because, you know, it might get sunk. Then, you know, that's not a weapon you want to have in your arsenal.
Well, it's a weapon you don't have in your arsenal is the bottom line. I mean, yeah. That's the reality, no matter what you spend on it. Let's take a look at, I want to show you a couple of things that happened in the Senate yesterday. One here, this is Senator Ossoff is pulling out his archives. And he's saying, Mr. Secretary, here are some things that you said about how Iran was effectively destroyed in the first week of the war. What say you now?
In the second week of the conflict, you stated that Iran's military had been, quote, destroyed and, quote, made combat ineffective. Was that an accurate statement?
What the American military has done to the Iranian military is a historic military defeat, and they're ineffective in that context.
Secretary, early in the conflict, day three, you said one of those core objectives was to, quote, destroy the missile threat, and as you restated on day five, to, quote, obliterate Iran's missiles and drones. Those were clearly and repeatedly stated core objectives of the campaign, which 4 months ago you declared had been completed victoriously with every single objective achieved. Were those objectives achieved 4 months ago?
No one ever stated that every single missile was gone. Ultimately, combat ineffective means they're not able to dig them out of their UGFs and shoot
had
at
the
us.
Missile threat
it doesn't mean they don't have underground facilities
ago.
Where they put missiles in them and hold on to them because they're the world's largest state sponsor of terrorism. So we never expected they would stop having capabilities to shoot. The question is, at scale against an opponent like the United States of America.
Okay, fine. We'll use that second standard. At scale, they are still combat effective, as they are shown nightly here.
Yeah.
What do you make of that?
Yeah, no, I mean, he's lying. He's just, you know, he's a buffoon. And I don't mean to do the personal attack, but good God, it just irritates me to no end that, you know, he's not an uneducated person, even though he's had, you know, he's had a mess of a personal life. But to just sit there and not be willing to confront the reality, which is Iran has a supply of ballistic missiles that we're not really sure how many they have, because they produce them underground, they deploy them underground, and we don't have see-through the underground structure ability. On top of that, there are reports. I can't confirm it. But it makes sense that China has supplied Iran with some additional missiles. Why? Because China wants to have them tested in a combat environment. Mm. It's one thing to put them out on the range, that the testing range, and say, oh, that works, but it's not actually going up against U.S. countermeasures. Now, reportedly, they provided some anti-ship missiles. So we'll see. Do they fire those anti-ship missiles? Do those missiles reach their target? Do they get defeated? But this is the dilemma the United States has got itself into. That one, it can't take out the missiles because they're underground and they're launching from underground. And then the Iranians fooled us in the first 3 weeks of the war that started on February 28th, when they deployed inflatable launcher. You know, they were decoys. It was like a replication of Patton's Ghost Army. And so we were blowing the hell out of plastic and wood decoys. But the actual launchers, they would come out, launch, and then scoot back into cover. And so without real time, you know, if you had a Predator overhead that spotted it and then was armed with a HARM missile, as soon as it spotted, it could fire and might have a chance of hitting it. But otherwise, by the time you hit it, you find it, and intel gets sent back to the Joint Operations Center or the CAT, and then they process it and they issue a fire mission, and the fire mission goes out looking for it. The thing could be long gone. And the United States ran into that problem both in the Red Sea when we tried to stop the Houthis, and the same problem that we encountered in Iran. And so then to make up for that, as we talked about earlier, they put the MQ-9 Reaper. We've got to get more Reapers in there. The more we put in, the more we get shot down. And we can't replace them. Again, on all of these precision-guided missiles, they need these particular kinds of magnets. China has the monopoly on those magnets. And they're saying, we're not selling it to you. So, Hegseth can take pride in having the most expensive military in the world, but it's certainly not the best.
Well, it's hard to argue with that when you're talking about the fundamentals and the realities here. But that doesn't get in the way for Secretary of War Pete Hegseth, because he will just vociferously argue that the sun comes up in the West and sets in the east. And you can't tell him any differently. Even if he watches it go down in the west, he'll still tell you, no, that's the east. As an example, given that as a setup, here was a pretty testy exchange between Senator Peters and Secretary Hegseth yesterday.
You don't have a strategy. You don't have a long-term plan to actually win this war. Win the war. The men and women are going to be able to do it, but they need to have leadership. When will you show leadership?
We have leadership.
When will you show leadership?
Why don't you show some leadership and stand up to your fellow Democrats who won't fund the troops, who stand and play partisan politics while you don't give us the money? You want to stand up here and talk about the troops? You won't show any political courage to actually fund our department because you have Trump derangement syndrome and can't actually commit to anything meaningful.
Well, what do you make of that there? Because who's right there?
Yeah, well, they can both be right, but actually, you know, the notion that the reason we're having trouble is we haven't spent enough money on the Pentagon, that there's not enough money for the Department of Defense. Give me a break. You know, we've been hearing this same damn argument. I started focusing on it back in 1990, so it's only been going on for 36 years. You know, right after when the Soviet Union collapsed, everybody thought, oh, man, we're going to get a peace dividend here. We don't have to spend as much on defense. Oh, no, 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 no. We had to find us a new enemy, Saddam Hussein. Oh, my God, he's got weapons of mass destruction. And nobody at the time pointed out, weren't we the ones that provided him with those weapons of mass destruction? Yeah, but ignore that. He's got them. So he became our new enemy. And with that enemy, we got to have more defense. We got to build this, you know. So we're always looking for a villain to fill the role in the script, in this narrative we can never find a reason to say, you know what, we need to step back. We need to dismantle a bunch of bases because, A, we can't protect them. If they're within range of any ballistic missile or drone, we can't protect them anymore. We don't have enough Patriot missile batteries to protect them. So, but we're this. I think this is ultimately where this whole affair is headed. Is that we will have such a catastrophic end to our military adventure in the Persian Gulf that it's finally going to force some sort of reckoning, where we have to sit back and really take a hard look at ourselves. Because we realize, you know, we got whooped, and we got whooped by the Iranians.
Yeah, that's what it's going to take. And, of course, we're not there yet because we can still keep the fiction going a little bit longer. But that's got an expiration date, and I think we're going to get there. Before I leave this topic here, because there's some other things from that Senate hearing on a different topic I want to get to, but I do want to get your view on something that you and I discussed a little bit before we came on air, and that is about President Trump's bragging that he is going to give authorization to the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia to do nuclear processing and enrichment of nuclear facilities. Given that we're trying to go into war against Iran because we don't want them to even have the capacity, how's this going to work?
Well, number one, the United States has no expertise in that area. It's been 50 years since the United States has built a nuclear reactor. That's number one. So we don't have the personnel to provide the guidance on construction. The ones that have that are Russia and France and China. China too has been becoming increasingly active in building nuclear facilities. The only functioning nuclear power facility in the entire Persian Gulf is in the United Arab Emirate. They don't have a single one in Saudi Arabia. So that means, and then where do you get the uranium from? Who provides that? Oh, that would be Russia. So, yeah, the United States, if it wants to make good on that promise, is going to have to work closely with either France, Russia, or China, and especially with Russia to make sure that Saudis can get the uranium they need to engage in the enrichment.
And I mean, how do we get past? I'm obviously in the United States, we could care less because double standards are irrelevant to us. We'll do double speak for breakfast in the morning without giving it a second thought. But others around the region and the world are going, hang on. You just said that Iran can't be trusted to have any kind of enrichment, even though the NPT gives them that treaty, gives them the authorization to do so. But now here you're saying you want to expand it to somebody else. How can these two things coexist? What are other people going to think about this?
Yeah, well, the logic has never been our strong suit in the United States of late. Our contradictions and our hypocrisy have been on display for quite some time. But, you know, I guess this is some sort of lame effort to try to threaten Iran and make, you know, add further to Iran's alleged paranoia. But I mean, the realities come into play. It's going to plan, design, and build this kind of facility. I think it's a minimum of 5 years. I've heard from somebody who's been involved with that business. So, you know, the world's going to change a lot in 5 years. So this is, again, this is more foolishness. What's really, though, happening to the United States right now is it's being driven out of the Gulf. Because we came in and promised all these countries, hey, you stick with us, we'll protect you, we got your back, man. Nobody will dare hit you because we're so big, we're so bad. And now they're all getting, you know, the daylights pounded out of them, and you know what, like the UAE, you know, even though it's the most pro-Israeli, and it has been involved with passing technology and secrets to the Israelis for years, it's gone out of its way to send money to Iran and try to say, hey, don't hit us, we're not allowing the U.S. flights to originate from our bases. Qatar, who Iran has had some decent relationships with, it didn't escape because of the presence at Al Udeid, and Al Udeid now basically, is my understanding, is headed towards becoming a ghost town. You know, I don't know if you ever ate at the TGIF Fridays that was on base there, but you know, I bet you their business is way down.
Yeah, I did spend a little. I didn't go to there, but I did spend some time on Al Udeid and Camp Buring and Kuwait and some of these others that have been hammered hard. And it's just hard for me to imagine that would have happened, Bob. But it has.
Yeah.
Listen, I want to shift gears here a little bit and go into the other war that's going on here, and that also was related in the Senate. Senator Kennedy asked General Kane a very interesting question regarding the outcome of that war.
In the war between Russia and Ukraine, who do we want to win?
Sir, I want Ukraine to win.
Is Russia America's friend?
I think that depends on your definition of friend. I think it's a complicated relationship. But no, I don't think they're our friends.
Jesus. Yeah.
Hey, go ahead. Yeah, I don't even have to set that one up.
I mean, come on. You know, this kind of 13-year-old mentality. I'm not sitting with you today at lunch.
He's not my friend.
Yeah, Jesus Christ. You know, can we identify what our interests, our national interests? Is it in the interest of the United States to be at potential war with the other nuclear power in the world, one of the other two major nuclear powers in the world? Or is it in the interest of the United States to have a peaceful relationship? Is it in the interest of the United States to have a good relationship with the country that's the largest provider of nitrogen for fertilizer in the world when we need fertilizer, or should we make them our enemy? Is it in the interest of the United States to be at war with the country that provides the processed uranium that we need to fuel our nuclear power?
Our own nuclear power.
Yeah. Let's see what we can do to piss off the Russians. We don't need them. I mean, this is just, let's embrace Ukraine. Ukraine, which is ideologically proven aligned with the Nazis of World War II, the Bandera movement. They are fascists. They are racist. They promote the values of the Nazis, which, you know, I thought that was our enemy. But, you know, even making it more ridiculous, Israel aligns itself with them. So, you know, you get the crocodile tears over the Holocaust on one hand, but then they happily go and embrace the folks who actually deny the Holocaust or have embraced it as something that was a good thing to do. And that's who Israel aligns itself with. So this notion that there are actually some countries out there with deep-seated principles, well, it doesn't apply to the United States, Israel, or Ukraine, for that matter. It's all a marriage of convenience.
Yeah, and that it's a pretty ugly marriage, as it turns out, in terms of effectiveness for the people that are involved with that. What do you make of the fact that for the third time in less than 1 year, Ukraine has gotten rid of its Minister of Defense, and then just earlier today, we had that Zelensky has ousted Ukraine's military commander, Sersky, which has kind of been expected for a long time. But the fact that you just got rid of the prime minister, the Minister of Defense, and then now the commander, what does that tell you about how things are going in the war with Iran?
They're winning. Don't you know, man? They're winning. Okay.
That's what it tells me.
This is what winners do. When you're winning and the war is going as great as it could be, you fire the commander who's in charge of your winning strategy, along with his chief of staff. Get rid of him, too. And then you get rid of the defense minister. Ukraine is in it's a mess, and it's not going to get better. This conflict between Sersky and Fedorov, who was the defense minister, Fedorov is, think of him as Pete Hegseth with better hair, okay? But he's like a 35-year-old guy. I mean, he's even younger than Hegseth, and just as poorly informed as Hegseth. In fact, I don't think he had any Fedorov had any military experience. So Fedorov was wanting to push all of the assets and resources into drone production. And, you know, there are lots of important people were making money off of that drone production. So there was, some benefits to be had. And Sersky was complaining, hey, yeah, you're taking resources that we need to get troops on the front lines, albeit, you know, we're having to dragoon people and force them out before they've had any training. But, you know, we're shorthanded and it's getting worse. And so there was that conflict. And so initially Zelensky came down on Sersky's side and fired Fedorov. Now, it also may have been that Fedorov was making money out of the drones and wasn't sharing it, you know, kicking it back to cocaine cowboy Zelensky. But, they fired Fedorov. Turns out Fedorov, though, you know, pretty face, handsome, popular. And so that generated a lot of protests from, and the key was that Europe liked him. So you could take him to a meeting and, you know, the Europeans would say, oh, we're comfortable with him. He wasn't like a big fat slob like Umarov, who was a caricature of a bad Ukrainian. So the people came out in protest. So then Zelensky got, you know, well, we got to do something. So then he fires Sersky and replaces him with a guy that the Russians have already now indicted for war crimes and are waiting to capture him and prosecute him. So things are great because this is what you see with a winning strategy. I mean, this just exposes how nonsensical these claims have been that, oh, yeah, Ukraine's winning, Russia's losing. Gerasimov still sits in his position as the general in charge of the entire Russian military at the top of the chief of staff. They haven't had any major shakeups there at least in the last 3 years. And they're getting results on the ground.
And it turns out that the Iranians, I mean, the Ukrainian side is also starting to change some of their tactics in the air. And here of late, they seem to be hitting a new set of targets. This was in Krasnodar, where another Wildberries factory was hit. Just made some extraordinary imagery that looks really bad. for the Russian side, because now that it seems to me that the Ukrainian side is now going after targets that don't have as much air defense. Russia has prioritized throughout its country the air defense on its military sites. Well, that's leaving just standard, like their Amazon delivery facilities open, and that's actually causing some real problems for the economy, especially of the small and medium-sized businesses inside of Russia. Russians are reacting to that, and they're really upset about a lot of it. What can you tell us about this change of strategy? Yeah, there's Gary's got his imagery there. This is the new one, not the one from a couple of days ago. What do you make of this?
Yeah, so anybody that's done some online ordering for their Depends or for their case of Coca-Cola, they may have to wait an extra couple of weeks. Oh my God. We don't have overnight delivery right now. That's the end of the world. Meanwhile, what Russia is doing is it's hitting every industrial manufacturing plant in Kyiv, and we've seen day after day. Oh, last night was the biggest missile strike ever, and then the day before, no, today was the biggest missile strike ever. Day before that, today was the, so they keep having the biggest missile strikes ever on those production facilities. Blowing up an Amazon is not the same as blowing up a drone manufacturer, blowing up an artillery manufacturer, blowing up something that has actual wartime application. That's number one. But in tandem with that, what Russia has done, they've now closed off Odessa. Odessa is now completely blockaded. Any ship trying to reach it, it's being blown out of the water. Any ship trying to load up there, it's getting hit while in dock. And they're doing the same to Nikolaev. And so they've basically cut Ukraine off from further resupply, at least through the Black Sea. Everything else is going to have to come overland. And on that front, Russia in the past 2 months has destroyed 200 locomotive engines. I don't know how many total Ukraine has, but I don't think they have another 200 in reserve. So they're also destroying the ability to resupply via railroad. Then you add in the ground operations, which are taking place, where you have the beginning of encirclements in Sumy and Kharkiv in the north, the development of a cauldron around Kramatorsk in Slavyansk, in Donetsk, which are the last two remaining strongholds. You've got Zaporizhia. Again, they've closed in on the outskirts of Zaporizhia. I think it's the largest remaining industrial town in Ukraine. They're also operating without much opposition in Dnipropetrovsk, and then the same in Kherson. So it's not just in one area. Now we're seeing the Russians have launched on a comprehensive front. So yeah, hey, the Ukrainians have got they've been able to attack civilian facilities that are undefended. That's like going around bragging that you beat up the kid in the wheelchair. I kicked his ass. Okay. Yeah, you're a real tough guy. Why don't you go? Let's step up against the guy that's actually your size, your weight. See how you do, and that's where again, Ukraine is in crisis, and again, what we've seen in the last 2 weeks with the attacks that Russia has mounted now on Kyiv, day after day after day after day, closing down Odessa and the ground operations, it's destroyed this Western propaganda that was being widely circulated that, Russia's on its back foot, Russian economy's collapsing, Russia's running out of oil, on and on and on. And it's not true.
The issue, though, Larry, is because the message and that myth is perpetuated when they see stuff like this Krasnodar shot, et cetera. So people can continue to believe that, and they're not even getting all the stuff. You just rattled off a whole list of things that are hidden. Almost none of that is on the Western press. People aren't even aware that it's happening. But let me show you something that is that did come out in the media here, because I think it's pretty safe to say that there are certainly a cabal of elite leaders in the West, and that's not just people in government, but the so-called elite, that much is very happy with all this because they want this war to continue on. So much so that this was in the Kiev Post today from the Welt and Telegraph here, I think the day before, is that Britain and Germany are quietly developing a new long-range missile capable of striking targets up to 2,000 kilometers inside Russia as part of a major expansion of European defense cooperation. According to a report by Die Welt and Telegraph, the classified deep precision strike program has become the flagship of a project of rapidly expanding security partnership between London and Berlin with Russia as the target. What kind of reaction do you expect to come out of the Kremlin on this?
Arashnik missiles. That's how they'll react. They'll take out and destroy those facilities. They won't even get to the manufacturing stage. Russia will preempt that. You know, Russia's made it clear they're past when Peskov spoke, I guess it's now 2 weeks ago, almost three, that the special military operation is over. We're at war with NATO. He was pretty very clear on that on two separate occasions. So look, there's no denying that while Russia does many things well, when it comes to information operations and touting its own successes, it sucks. It's awful. I've recommended, and not tongue in cheek, and I don't have any official line of communication with the Russian government, but I say, guys, go hire those kids out of Tehran that were doing the Lego videos. You know, they were incredible. They were powerful. They were they actually influenced public opinion, because you also need to influence public opinion. Now, one of the things that it was so sorely lacking in the United States is a positive message about Russia, that we're still locked in this. So many people are still locked in this idea that Russia is this communist state, that it's an authoritarian state, that there's no freedom, there's no ability to express yourself, that they're locking everybody up in the gulag, that kind of mentality. And the average American doesn't realize that Russia is a deeply Christian nation, and very devout Christian nation, and big emphasis upon family, and it's reflected in what you see in the society over there, where the streets are clean, there's not a lot of crime.
You spent quite a bit of time in Russia here in the last couple of years, is that right?
Yeah, I've been there seven times since 2023. And not just in Moscow and St. Petersburg, but also talking to people that have been out around the country. I'm in touch with the American expats who live there. One is a former West Point graduate. He was a classmate of Keith Alexander, who used to be the head of the National Security Agency. They report on it. It's a vibrant life, and the nice thing about it is, the Russians aren't sitting there conspiring, figuring out how they can conquer the world. They had to build up their military as a result of this war with Ukraine that was sponsored by and pushed by NATO. Over the last 36 years, going back to, or 26 years, going back to 2000, when Putin really came into power, Russia wasn't devoting its resources to building up military force to project in other countries. It was rebuilding its economy and its society, which has been done, and it's spectacular. Those who've had been fortunate to see it.
And last question I got for you is, you said that the Russians are doing a terrible job of marketing and whatever communication, so that none of those messages are getting out as well. But the Western European leaders in particular, even worse than in the United States, only want to talk about Russia in those, good and evil, whatever. They're definitely the evil side, et cetera. And the only thing they're doing is like what we just showed you on this current deal. They're looking at, and by the way, that was supposed to be effective in 2034. But it's still, it's the idea that we don't even want to contemplate any kind of an end of the war with Russia, any kind of end of the conflict. We're looking to plan out years in advance, and we just want to keep going on that direction. Is that even sustainable for Europe?
Oh, yeah, no, not at all. And in fact, I was, when you're showing this missile, I think, well, man, I'm sure the Chinese are going to be willing to pony up some of those rare earth minerals, because the reality is, if you're going to launch a missile that's going to travel 2,000 miles, you're going to have that precision guidance system in it. That precision guidance system depends on these magnets, which China controls. And until somebody comes up with a new engineering solution, that's the reality. That's what you got to build with. And so in that regard, it's delusional. But again, it gets back to this mentality. And I think about this going back to our decision to attack Saddam Hussein after he went into Kuwait over an oil dispute back in 1990, in August of 1990, that we were not, even though I'd been at the CIA and was now at state counterterrorism, nobody pulled me aside and told me, hey, Johnson, do you realize we've been working closely with Saddam the previous 9 years in that war that we helped them launch against Iran? And that we'd had regular meetings, and we provided him chemical weapons. We provided him biological weapons. So the question is, after he launched that invasion, why it was our initial response that we have to respond militarily, as opposed to, let's sit down and talk to him. Let's find a diplomatic way out of this. Because we did have once a relationship with him. And the only reason we didn't is we needed a new enemy so that we could justify a multi-million, billion-dollar defense industry. And I see that Gary's showing the bodies of the latest dead from the war with Iran are being returned.
Yeah, see, that's a dignified transfer there. I got pretty mixed feelings about that. I mean, I'm always honored, always want to honor them when they come in, because they all signed up with the expectation they were going to defend our country. And I just find it an egregious violation of that trust that we placed in our government when they're being misused like this and killed pointlessly. But we have that as it may. Listen, I know we're out of time here, but I really appreciate you coming on today and providing this clarity that we have here. Always a value to it. And thanks for coming on.
Hey, enjoy our discussion. I guess we'll be together in about 10 days, 12 days.
Yes, we will. Yeah, less than 2 weeks now, we will be together with Brother Robert Barnes and Alexander Mercurius and a number of other folks in Tennessee. I think there's still a few tickets left if anybody wants to go see that there. It's the 1776 Law Firm with Robert Barnes there, and always a great stuff. Looking forward to that. They'll definitely see you there in person here shortly.
All right, brother. Thanks.
All right, man. See you there, and we will see you guys. May come back later this afternoon. There's one other thing that I might want to try to get around to. Just keep watching your ticker there. Be sure and like and subscribe so that you get notified when the next video comes up here. But in any case, if anything does break in between now and then, you can count on the Daniel Davis Deep Dive to bring it to you live. Thanks, then. You know, I don't try to talk you into buying gold or tell you how to run your stock portfolio, but there is a way you can help us. Subscribe, hit that like button, and share this with somebody you love.